How can you find, fund, and fix planet-sized problems? First, you need to be informed. And that starts here with the DOI Podcast.
Yes, it does. Welcome in, ladies and gentlemen. 7/28/22, show number 69, if you're keeping track. Welcome into the most meaningful crypto conversation on the interwebs this morning. That's because it involves you. Gang, we have a special show for you today. Crowdfunded Cures is going to be joining us. We're excited to talk to these guys. They've got some pretty interesting things happening over there, and we're going to jump into it. Ripple's in the news. Turkey's in the news. And what is the news without a U.S. senator speaking up? Let's cover it together. Corey Fico, how are you doing this morning?
Oh, I'm doing fantastic. I have to say, I'm almost as excited to talk about crowdfunded cures as I am the senators.
Well, you know, senators do keep it, they do keep it fresh for us here in the United States, always talking some kind of silliness.
Yeah, that's true. But at the end of the day, we have to be very mindful of what they're saying, because they are forming the laws that will determine what we can and can't do in Web3. So the kinds of concepts such as being able to have rewards-based bounties around solving an off-patent drug issue, or being able to do that or not, or turning that into a security or not.
Right.
Those kinds of conversations revolve around people making laws.
Yeah. Well, and you know what? It doesn't really matter that this is kind of new to them and they don't understand it fully. They've never met something they couldn't make a law for. So no problems.
Aren't most things a lot easier to figure out if you have no idea at all, but an extreme amount of confidence?
Ooh, that's true. And they don't lack confidence. That's not something they have a problem with.
Yeah. You can hear somebody say something. You're like, I understand four of those words. I'm going to jump right into that.
I can make a law for you.
Yeah. I've got it.
Yeah. Well, I don't think any of them could find their way through the metaverse if they tried. But here they are. They're going to make all the rules for it. And they've done such a fantastic job with the last economic system. I don't see any way they can go wrong, to be quite honest with you.
You know what? Maybe they should have their own metaverse that's set up just like their bills, where it's like a series of rooms that are like all super complicated and come back to themselves over and over and over again. There's like 2,200 rooms, each with like a different concept inside of it.
Yeah. They'll mess it up. Just give them a few more minutes. Certainly don't give them any ideas on how to mess it up, because that is just something that they naturally are able to do.
There'll be a barrel of pork in one of those rooms before too long.
It'll just be a pork metaverse by the time they're done. So let's jump into it. SEC versus Ripple. You know, Ripple is going at it with them, right? And the SEC is on a little bit of a, I wouldn't say that they're on a new power trip, right? Because that is their thing, right? Is regulations. But it seems like they're trying to find their footing in this new world, right? Like, they really don't know where they belong. And they're like, oh, hell no, we belong here. We're going to start regulating something right now. And Ripple's like, hold on, bro.
Yeah. So to that, so the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission played its cards to revoke the amica curiae status granted to XRP holders. Different filings against it depicted that said narrative. Nevertheless, the defendant came back relentlessly to counter the plaintiff's filings on several occasions. So essentially here, it looks like the attorney, John Deaton, led a group of XRP holders in the filing to motion to intervene in the case back in March 2021. Although their attempt got rejected in the court last October, they did manage to obtain that amici status, thereby aiding XRP holders to incorporate friends of the court briefs. So essentially, the way that I am interpreting this, not as a lawyer, is this allows them to understand what's going on inside of the case because of the fact that they're connected to the case as holders. And therefore, that's telegraphing what's happening to the rest of the world, the case in live time, as best I understand it. So in that, I guess the SEC is trying to revoke that.
Yeah.
So,
well, hey, Ripple's 2-for-2 right now, right?
Oh, gosh. I mean, at this point in time, if you were to check the boxes on everything, kind of all the little smaller attacks that were made against them, I don't even know what it would look like. I think that might actually be something to have one of those trackers.
Just against the SEC, though, they're 2-for-2, right?
Oh, yeah. But, I mean, as far as, like, the SEC, like, all the different angles, I think it might be nice to kind of, like, a heavyweight bout to, like, have a website you could go to see, like, all the different, like, attacks and whether or not they landed, and to truly see the way that the championship fight is
settling. It's got to make you feel good, right, if you go up against the SEC and you win twice.
Oh my gosh. I mean, if you're Ripple, I mean, every single day, it's like you're getting a breath of borrowed life. You're like, I'm going to cherish the moment.
Are the attorneys like superstars when they walk into the Ripple office? Like everybody stands up and cheers.
I would imagine they would have to be. They sure would be to me.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, we're finding them to be a little bit heroish now, and we don't even know them. So, Turkish finance minister meets virtually with the Binance founder. You know, we've been following Binance. You know, a few months ago, the community wisely chose Binance to jump out first, and it was a good decision, right? We watch what they're doing, and they are everywhere.
They are everywhere. They really are. I have to say, and I've said it before, I'll say it again, the concerted effort of Binance to become legally accepted and regulated mm-hmm. in every country and district that they can, and to become part of that Web3 ecosystem and infrastructure to help build it. They started in Asia and moving across the Middle East, and you can see them moving mm-hmm. into Europe and even South America. They are clearly making the moves to build this out, and in a way that I don't think anyone besides maybe like Polygon could, but Polygon doesn't have nearly the resources that Binance does.
No, they're asleep at the wheel right now. Well, they did just announce a couple big things. It was a couple weeks back. They made a couple deals with a couple local governments also, but they're not even touching what Binance is doing.
Yeah, I think that Polygon isn't so much asleep at the wheel as they are just a fraction of the size. I mean, so it's like, I mean, if you have 80 times the resources.
Sure. Sure. Well, it makes you wonder, like, so right now there's a bunch of Bitcoin maximalists, right? They're like, Bitcoin is the only way to go. And they're really the only ones that are hyping Bitcoin constantly, right? Now, that sure, a lot of people find value in it and as a store of value, but they don't really have a good cheerleader like Binance does.
Well, I would say that they do. And like, there's actually, I believe it's like right now there's a Bitcoin conference in Miami or just finished or something like that. But they do have some like Anthony Pompliano and Tom Bass. And like there are some people that are really, really pumping it as a concerted effort, but it seems more like people who benefited from it. And I'm huge proponent of Bitcoin, and this isn't to speak against Bitcoin, but they don't have the same way to get together and say, okay, let's get a $10 billion infrastructure loan or $100 billion infrastructure loan to create a Web3 ecosystem across Saudi Arabia. Like, they don't have that kind of power that Binance does or is creating.
Right. Well, you know, I probably should have stayed in the Bitcoin. I sold all of my Bitcoin and bought Let's Go Brandon coins back when they were huge.
Everything about it that flopped. Was probably a poor decision. We actually need to follow up on what happened to that senator.
It Chatsworth, and it has nothing yet.
Really?
Right? Nothing new. But yeah, when it happens, we'll let you know, because it's an interesting story. He's out pumping it, and is possibly in a little bit of trouble for it. But
yeah, insider. The question is there any kind of insider issues? Like, do you take responsibility for pumping a meme coin and then it?
I think everybody
financially
who created
benefiting
it,
from
well,
it.
I think it was so stupid that everybody who created it and promoted it should maybe just get a spanking. You know what I mean? It was a juvenile kind of thing to do.
I mean, it was, but I mean, I wonder what percentage of that group might be happy to hear you say that.
Withdrawn.
All right. So that said, we always can cover a lot of amazing news, but we definitely want to bring in crowdfunded cures before too long here. That said, I know one of the things we were going to do is jump into maybe this third bit of news, maybe jump into what Kyler had going on.
Yeah. U.S. Senate proposes bill to make crypto transactions under $50 tax-free.
Yep. Well,
that's not a bad idea, but I mean, so if it's any transaction that's under $50, is that buying, trading, selling? You know, so I could just set it up to buy at $50 increments all day long and sell at $50 increments. So
yeah, well, so there's a couple things about that. It seems like it could be it's a good effort towards, hey, let's take small denominations and not try to tax it to death. And that especially helps people who are on the lower economic side of the scale. But alternatively, you say a crypto transaction, well, by whom and where? So is it like if you buy a shirt with crypto at $52, is that considered a transaction? Well, yeah, but you know, who's the taxing authority? Is it the taxing authority for where you sure. bought the shirt from? Is it, do you get taxed for sending $52? And also too, like there are times where like inside of a family or inside of like, cause right now you can gift up to like $650 if I remember correctly. I wonder like where the lines are at for that. Like, do they just mean like with exchanges? Do they mean for purchasing goods? Is it some kind of blanket statement of both? And like to your point, is there like a limit on the number of transactions? Because right. 50 times, you know, 20 million, that's transactions. Yeah. You know, you can get whatever amount of, Goldman Sachs can get the whole thing tax-free.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, they will anyways.
Yeah.
There's a loophole.
But to that point, if it's on the receiving side, I think that that's something to be said about taxing, you know, legitimately, making sure that tax authorities can and should, you know, give unto Caesar what is his. But at the same time, if it's on the sending side, it makes you kind of wonder, kind of like the India crypto bill, where you start getting taxed just for both sides of transactions, and it gets very, very expensive and not conducive whenever there isn't profit being made.
Right. Right. Well, it's tricky, but they're going to give us something that is, I'm sure, is very wonderful coming out of DC, and you can be sure that there's going to be loopholes built into it, so just don't worry about it.
Yeah,
do true. Do what they do, you'll be fine. So, you know, guys, if you're checking us out over on Facebook this morning, unfortunately, we're not on Clapper this morning. Had a little technical difficulties. Clapper is difficult sometimes to sync up to. I don't know why. But if you're over there and you would like to jump into the conversation over here on Discord, come on over. We are getting ready to get into a conversation with the guys over at Crowdfunded Cures. And this is something that everybody's going to want to pay attention to. By my estimation, this is the kind of project that brings or has potential to bring masses into this space, right? To yeah. seek understanding because they see something that tickles their interest. They're like, oh, wow, this is big. All of us have grandparents that have dealt with these kind of issues if we're not dealing with them ourselves, right? Medications and the craziness of getting involved in that. This is going to be an interesting conversation. And something else we're going to highlight, we're going to bring in Kyler if he's into it. If we talked to him about doing this,
We have not, but and I'm sure that he would be. But so I just dropped a link right above the Crowdfunded Cures website link. Kyler has started making a weekly legal roundup, so edition number 12 of Around the Blockchain. So yeah. It's a pretty fantastic amalgamation of interesting things that have happened over that week of time. So the one that's linked up into the Discord, it's from 7:18 to 7:25, so just a few days ago. And so it starts with from the SEC calls 9 crypto securities, and then it specifies AMP, RLY, DDX, XYO, RGT, LCX, Power, DFX, and Crom. I'm surprised they didn't try to make a power play and put an XRP in there.
And why do you think they didn't?
Because they're in the middle of that lawsuit for that yeah. exact reason. Yeah. But yeah. But yeah, so for those who needed that clarity, it steps into that and specifies exactly which ones are called securities. Yeah, and I think the one thing we did want to talk about, and then we're going to bring up Crowdfunded Cures, is how the same law firm is representing Celsius, Voyager, and Babel Finance.
Yeah. Yeah, power firm. The power Ooh. Firm of DC. What law firm is it?
Kirkland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, if they handle DUIs or anything, that's the one you want to get. Seems yeah, like they got the juice.
Yeah, apparently. Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
Actually, so if they're going to be Web3 attorneys, they're only going to handle DUIs in the metaverse.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. But you have to be a 3.0 in there, so.
No, I mean, I'm not really sure how that would
New
work.
Rules.
But, yeah, so they say that the reason why they chose Kirkland is for their demonstrated success in Chapter 11 proceedings. Which, I mean, if you're Kirkland, my gosh, that what a windfall.
Yeah.
The amount of money that you're going to take and also the status from that. My question is if there's anything to do with party members being so interconnected between the three firms?
No. Can't be.
I don't know. I mean, I'm curious. I want to get to the bottom of that. But nonetheless, I mean, kudos to Kirkland. What a win.
Yeah, no doubt. Well, you know, if you're a Chapter 11, if you're a bankruptcy attorney in general, you're winning when everybody else is losing.
Truly.
So
I think that's enough of the news for now, so that way we can bring up the gentleman from Crowdfunded Cures, because I know you
yeah,
are.
Yeah, this is exciting. Really, I'm excited to talk to these guys. We're going to be bringing Nick and Sava up here, and we're going to get into this conversation. Gentlemen, how are you doing this morning?
Morning. Nice to be here.
Good morning. Yeah, I guess for you guys, it's evening right now, isn't it?
Almost.
Almost.
Based in Berlin, but originally from the United States.
Okay, awesome. So you don't see Corey sitting up here with me. He's usually right up here with us, but we're in the studio together today, so it's just coming through mine. Corey, say hi.
Hey there. He's proving that I'm not his multiple personality. Thank you for that.
That's right. We have to talk at the same time.
So that said, gentlemen, we have been following Crowdfunded Cures for quite some time, and then, of course, having the opportunity, yes, Sava, to see you speak at DAO Planet NYC and really think about how powerful it is, not just for the Web3 space, but more importantly for in real life, kind of what it means to be able to bring forth something like this. Perhaps maybe if you would, and Nick, Sava, whichever one of you would want to take this one, give a little bit of a background on what Crowdfunded Cures is, and ultimately, and I saw it on the website, it was really powerful, you know, why it started, what the background story is, why you care.
Sure. I mean, yeah, I guess it did start from some personal experience, which I had with family members and my fiance at the time getting sick. But that was back in 2013. That's when I set it up. So it's kind of pre-crypto. But I think there is definitely a use case for crypto. And I think there's a lot of things that are coming together now, almost like a perfect storm, particularly around all the kind of talk about repurposing. And it was kind of set off by, and that's what got me really into it. But my background is commercial and IP law, but I'm also a patent attorney. And I did my thesis at the time on basically what I saw was a gap in the incentives for developing new drugs and therapies. So essentially all of biopharma, the entire kind of biopharma industry, is focused on creating new patentable molecules, because basically that's the only way they can make money. And if they don't have a patent, if you don't have the ability to create a new molecule and enforce a monopoly price over it, then nobody's interested, and it doesn't matter if, you know, this could be the cure for your disease or whatever it might be. If you can't make money out of it, then you can't make your money back from doing clinical trials. The idea is that essentially the solution is a prize-based model, or a pull incentive, so essentially what we call a pay-for-success contract. So as an alternative to patents. So if you successfully treat this particular disease using a intervention, it doesn't matter if it's an off-patent drug, or it could be a psychedelic, or it could be a supplement, or it could be a diet or a lifestyle intervention, then you should get paid for that on the basis that it actually saves health insurers and governments more money, because it could be more effective than a patented drug. So that's kind of, I guess, a bit of a summary in a nutshell and what we're about. The Web3 aspect, and we can dive into that a bit, is basically around how to allow people to basically invest in these new kinds of therapies. So if you were going to invest in repurposing an off-patent drug, say fluvoxamine to treat COVID or ketamine to treat major depression, there's no real way you can do that now in the patent system. So instead we can use IP NFTs as a way to kind of create like a product that people can invest in. And then we have these impact NFTs, which basically serve as like the buyer or of that data. If you successfully repurpose ketamine to treat depression, even if it's a cheap drug, then what you're paying for is the clinical trials proving that it works.
And that's so, for those who don't have the background in this, And I thought that you dove into this exceptionally well into in New York City was, why is there the requirement of a monopoly price? Like, if you're running into a situation like that, why can't you do, let's say, a not $800 drug? Why can't you bring about a $10 drug? Like, why don't pharmacy companies touch that?
Yeah, well, it's basically about the business model. I mean, you definitely could. You could sell your drug at $10 if you wanted to. And that's the point, is that a lot of drugs are basically off patent. So they are like that. In fact, 90% of the drugs that your doctor prescribes are called off patent or generic drugs. So usually they're quite cheap or significantly cheaper than the branded patented drugs. But the problem is that because they're so cheap, what you actually need is, it's not the value. The value isn't actually the drugs themselves. It's the clinical trials showing that the drugs work. And so what happens is the FDA have these requirements to do a phase one, phase two, and phase three clinical trials. And these can cost kind of tens to hundreds of millions of dollars, depending on the disease and things like that. And what the only way you can get your money back under the current system is to charge a very high price for your new drug. But without, you know, a patent incentive, no one's going to do the large clinical trials. And that's creating this market failure. And what happens at the moment is, if your drug is a generic drug, if it's off patent, it could be very cheap, but it could treat your disease. It could treat depression or COVID or cancer or whatever. But no one will fund the large clinical trials that will show definitively that it works, because there's no way they can make their money back. So that's how we're proposing, like a prize-based incentive to do this, like a what we call a pay-for-success contract. Like, you know, if you repurpose generic off-patent ketamine to treat depression, even though that's a very cheap drug, you'll get, say, $100 million bounty or payout, and you can crowdfund that bounty or payout, which is a little bit like a Kickstarter, where you kind of pre-purchasing something that doesn't quite exist yet.
So that's incredibly powerful. If I were looking at ways to be meaningful myself, and I had the ability to perform clinical trials or some part of research in that, I couldn't help but be drawn to that personally. Now, that said, so thinking about that pay for success model, which I also think, I mean, it's brilliant. Where does one go about kind of finding these opportunities, or for that matter, how does anyone know that a generic drug might have multiple different uses, or how does one go about kind of determining that they can just step into this and provide some value towards achieving that bounty? Do they do that individually? Do they do that as a group? Where do they go?
Yeah, so I mean, the benefit of this model is that as the payer, so like as the people that are raising the bounty, you only have to pay for successful outcomes, so successful clinical trials, successfully repurposed drugs. What happens is the bounty is a bit like it creates this market now that didn't exist previously, and now the markets are actually incentivized to go out. Like VCs can go out and try and, you know, look through the literature and find what are the low hanging fruit. And there are actually hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of generic drugs that could be repurposed. I mean, I could list sort of dozens and dozens of them. So it's not really that we don't know what they are. It's that we know what they are, but the clinical trials are expensive to do, and there's no upside if you take that. But it's not 100% chance that you're going to get there. It might, for a lot of drugs, you know, they do fail in large clinical trials. But let's say it's around 70% or 80% or 50%. You know, it's still going to be, you're putting a lot of money at risk, and then you're not getting any upside if you're successful in that risk. So what we're trying to do is provide the demand for the upside by basically funding these bounties for showing that these work. And then basically the market, you know, goes out and automatically finds which drugs might work. But yeah, we can talk about specific use cases, and Nick, you know, even did some of that for his master's research. He was looking at antipsychotics to treat cancer. So there's no lack of potentially effective off-patent drugs to treat new diseases. There's just no market for them.
So I have a question, Sava. If there are many uses for some of these drugs, off-patent uses, is this like kind of, is it basically the idea that you have to do the research just to make it aware that they can be used? Or are there already lots of doctors that understand there are other uses and prescribe them on a, you know, kind of on a one-off basis, but you're looking for something more recognized, right? That this drug, although it was created for, you know, cancer, will work for a broken arm, right? That kind of thing. You're wanting the research that shows that it is effective so that it can be prescribed for that.
Correct. Yeah. So basically it's about the data. I mean, you are legally allowed to, as a doctor, prescribe drugs off label. The problem is you're taking on a lot of risk and liability. So a lot of your general GPs are not going to do that. You're going to have to go to a specialist, and that's going to be A, very expensive, and B, most of the time, insurance companies will not reimburse an off-label use because of the lack of data from large clinical trials. So basically, if you had more data showing that this drug was effective for this new use, then you know you would get more doctors prescribing it, and then eventually you would actually get the government or health insurers reimburse it, so there wouldn't be a cost associated. So, for instance, with ketamine, you know, you can get ketamine off-label to treat treatment-resistant depression, but you need to go to a private clinic, and it's, you know, you're basically paying out of pocket, and it's around, you know, $1,200 in the US. It's around $6,000 or $7,000 in the UK, and that's out of reach of most people, particularly if you're depressed and things like that. So, you know, that's a minor kind of example, but it kind of, you know, for other drugs, it could be even more. But, you know, if there was an FDA-approved version of generic ketamine to treat depression, then, you know, your health insurer would reimburse those clinic costs and you know, you wouldn't necessarily have much of a copay. But, you know, what's lacking is the incentive to actually get pay for the clinical trials to get FDA approval. And that's what's missing, and that's what we're trying to look at with this pay-for-success model.
Wow. So, Nick, I'd like to hear a little bit more about what you were working on. It sounds like it's antipsychotic for cancer patients. Is that correct?
That's right. My background's in molecular medicine. I have a master's in that. My master thesis focused on repurposing antipsychotic against colon cancer metastasis. The working hypothesis was that it downregulated a gene that's associated with the spread of colon cancer. It was really early stage, very preclinical, meaning that it was done in cells. However, you know, we did find some mechanisms of action that could be translated into a clinical setting. However, we needed a bit more robust therapy. Nonetheless, there are lots of different therapeutics out there that could be repurposed. Like I was, you know, like over around 90% of FDA-approved drugs could be used for an additional therapy because these diseases, they share very similar disease pathways, and that's the hypothesis that we, you know, well, it's kind of known, scientifically proven. So that's what we're hoping to push out. So it could be antipsychotics, it could be anything, really. We just need to get the data out there and develop the right incentivization mechanisms to pull that data into the clinical setting, right? So lots of interesting developments potentially. And that's what I hope to bring, is my scientific expertise as well as my connections into this.
So you said something that I'm sure I heard right, and I even wrote down, but I have to verify. Did you say 90% of FDA drugs, approved drugs, have multiple uses that we know about? Was that the right number? I didn't like hear, was it 19%?
90, yeah, potentially 90, right. So if you, I think, whoa, Francis Collins, the former head of the NIH in the United States, mentioned that, yeah, there's a ton of different use cases for drugs that have already been approved.
Okay.
So. And then actually what happens as soon as you can see it, it's very clearly, there's been a couple of studies done where as soon as the drug goes off patent and it becomes available as a generic, and then that, you know, they make it in India and China and places like that, its chance of getting repurposed for a new use drops to like almost zero. So you can see this clear pattern, which it's a, this economic reason, and it's not really a scientific reason why the drugs sort of suddenly stop being scientifically useful, essentially. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. So that also leads me to ask a question, which is, I guess, correlated, but not exactly under this crowdfunded cures, I don't think, is whenever a on-patent drug comes in and it's for one purpose, can it be used for other purposes by other people, or does it only get used for that one purpose that the pharmaceutical company brought it forth for?
Yeah, so usually what happens is you do get a drug being repurposed for more than one use, and usually that happens during the term of the patent. So there's a peak at around 6 years after it's been approved, and then there's another kind of smaller peak around 5 years before it kind of, yeah, well, a few years before it runs out of the patent. But most 90% of repurposing happens while the drug is on patent. And then what, you know, once it goes off patent, essentially there are no more private incentives to do it, because you can't make your money back from charging a high price.
I see. So essentially the concept is that there is a certain amount of money that has to be spent by a pharmaceutical company in order to bring it forth, in order to get it tested, in order to market it, in order to sell it and distribute it, etc. And the intellectual property that they have, which makes sense for the form of law that you went into, the IP that they have, they get to choose how they use it. So they're not going to get creative with it, even if they understand it has other uses, until they feel like they have to in order to offset maybe a dip in sales. Am I kind of understanding that correctly?
I mean, they will put, pharmaceutical companies will put a lot of effort into repurposing, but okay, only while it's on patent. And the problem is that a lot of drugs, you might only discover they're useful for a new use sort of 10 years, 20 years after they're no longer patentable. And it's often the case where researchers will find, you know, like Nick, will find, hey, this older drug is extremely effective. It presses this button in your body and it downregulates this particular gene. But unfortunately, there's no private incentive to then, you know, repurpose that drug and prove that it's actually effective. So there's this massive, lost opportunity.
Yeah, so that actually, I think, helps a little bit here. And so Shelley in the chat, the Discord chat, asked, does repurposing drugs mean identifying new therapeutic uses for old drugs? It seems like in that way that there is actually a lot of data, not only on how it was previously used, but how it could be repurposed, that was done during the time where the patent was happening by the previous patent holders, which is why you have so much evidence for the fact that there's other use cases. Am I correct in understanding that, or would you reframe or re-say that differently?
I mean, a lot of it would be done by the pharma company, but a lot of it would also be done by researchers studying the drug. But yeah, I think suffice to say, there is probably a lot of data for most drugs that show that it could be used for different uses than its original use, just because drugs kind of have these sort of multiple effects and they don't just necessarily do one thing. So that they are useful for more than one disease or more than one use. We know about them. The problem is that once the patent runs out, there's no more private incentives to fund the large clinical trials, phase two and phase three, to prove that that they are actually safe and effective versus a placebo in these randomized controlled trials, basically, that are, you know, 10, 20, 30, 50 million plus. Without a patent, you won't get any private company doing this research. Unless it is a little bit subtle, though. It's not a black and white point, because sometimes what they can do is they can reformulate these drugs and basically tweak the molecule a bit or combine them with another drug. And then that will be sufficient to basically make it almost like a new drug, and they'll get a new composition of matter patent. And then that's will potentially allow them to get, you know, to take that to market. But that doesn't often happen. And the other more important point is often, or a lot of the time, the original formulation of the drug is very effective. Like we saw this kind of with you know, there are drugs that can treat, for instance, got a lot of hype. I don't even want to talk about it, but hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin and things. Now, they're not necessarily, I'm still agnostic as to whether those work or not, but there's been a lot of money spent on those, like apparently over $6 billion spent on clinical trials for ivermectin, and they still haven't shown any efficacy, and that's through like public push funding. But, you know, if there was an actual private mechanism for a private company to take it to market, it would be a lot more efficient, and you could get, a lot, potentially find out that, you know, which drugs actually do work, you know, because you've got the kind of super intelligence of the markets and potentially leveraging crypto as well.
So in that way, and we've got another couple great questions in the chat, it seems to me, to kind of summarize, because my question would be is how do people know that of multiple uses? One, you've stated is that during the course of being on patent, there is a private incentive to understand its uses, but also two, it seems like there is a bit of just trial and error because of the fact that things have multiple outcomes and being able to identify that, or, you know, by accident, if you will. And is that kind of correct? Is that data is then pooled together where people can kind of outside who want to step into this, who go, you know what, I want to be a part of this bounty. They have a clear vision on where they might start because of just basically the data that shows what happened by accident. Or is there some other third mechanism that is outside of those two where there's just really helps to pull this data together for someone who wants to know where to start to basically achieve a bounty?
Yeah, well, our focus, as I was saying, our focus is actually on raising the bounty first. Because once you raise the bounty, say we can raise like $10 million or something for psychedelic research or something that's off patent. What will happen is that because those bounties are available, you will automatically get the market looking through the evidence and finding, you know, the lowest hanging fruit, I guess the ones that have the least risk and the most evidence is out there. But they still have no financial incentive without the bounty, and then they could go and fund those things. But yeah, I mean, you were saying like, yeah, often with a lot of medical discoveries, it's just a complete accident. And, you know, we don't know why lithium works for depression. And, you know, even now we don't even know if the antidepressant drugs work and things like that. So, you know, many, many drugs, you're not even, they're kind of discovered by accident. But, you know, if there is no private incentive to do the clinical trials, it doesn't matter that you discover it might be effective in like animal trials, early stage trials, or even if you do it in a very small clinical trial, maybe you get funding from the government for, you know, $500,000 to do a small clinical trial. It's not really going to influence doctors' prescriptions, behaviors in a scalable way. What you want is to kind of update standard of care. You know, you want your drug to be added to the clinical guidelines for treating this particular disease so doctors know about it and they know to prescribe it. And that's not going to happen without very large sort of phase 2, phase 3 clinical trials, basically. And that's where we have this kind of lack of data. But there's no lack of like substrate that, you know, potential drugs that could be repurposed. And we know about lots of them. As I say, I could name hundreds of them probably. What's lacking is the incentive, and that's what we're really focusing on, is creating that bounty, because once you do that, kind of then you get these kind of network effects and basically crowdsource the solution from the market.
So Sav, I've got a question. You talked about the patents on medications. How long does a medication patent last? Like, if you have the original patent, how long is that going to be good for?
So typically, it's 20 years from filing. For pharmaceutical patents, you can get another 5 years on top of that. That's in most jurisdictions. The problem is that the patents are filed very early on in the kind of drug discovery process, and you kind of have to start immediately because getting from preclinical to phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 trials can take over 10 years. So by that time, you might only have sort of 10 to 15 years left to basically sell your drug. the average is around 12 years, which on the market, and that's kind of, you know, pharmaceutical companies say they need at least that to make their money back.
Well, I mean, and that makes sense, at least. I mean, I think that that story is almost important for people who might want to demonize a pharmaceutical company to understand that they've got a decade of expenses on something they don't even know they can bring to market that they have to somehow make up for with monopoly pricing. I mean, that's kind of the way that I'm interpreting that. Am I interpreting that correctly? Or is there some other lens, perhaps, where you could say, no, there could be a different way that they could do all this and bring them to market for less and actually still stay in business?
Yeah, I mean, so from my perspective, I'm not anti-pharma, the model. They're basically just playing the game that they're given, the cards that they've got. And the only card they've got is charging a monopoly price for a new patent. What I would have a problem with is payers, basically governments and health insurers, paying billions and billions of dollars for patented drugs and not basically incentivizing other kinds of interventions like repurposing off-patent drugs that could be done for, you know, a tenth of the price. If they did a, you know, a bounty of $100 million, that could create a repurpose an old drug for like a hundredth of the price to, you know, treat a lot more people at basically no cost, almost no cost. So it's not the pharma companies I'm blaming. I think it's more about the, you know, they're just playing the only business model they have. But we need to sort of update those business models and create these pay-for-success incentives, which would essentially make the delivery of healthcare a lot more efficient. But yeah, I broadly agree. Also, that the other point I'll just mention this briefly is that creating a new drug is, as I was saying, it can be up to 100 times more expensive than repurposing an old drug. And they do say, sort of, they've been throwing numbers out there, although it's been disputed, but that, you know, every new drug costs around $1 billion to, you know, plus, you know, up to $4 billion, depending on who you ask, to generate, because A, you've got to go through that 10 to 15 years. So there is the opportunity costs of not investing that money. And then B, you've also got this quite high chance of clinical trial failure. So you've got to factor in all the failed clinical trials. However, with generic drug repurposing, with repurposing old drugs, you can actually go straight to phase three straight away. So, and you know, you could actually get to FDA approval in 3 years or 2 years or 1 year, or not, probably not 1 year, but a lot less time than sort of the 10, 15 years. So if you want to get cures out there faster to patients, you know, it makes sense to try this pay for success model. And it could be, you know, a lot cheaper, sort of, you know, $100 million incentive might be enough, and it might only cost you kind of $30 to $50 million to repurpose a generic drug.
Yeah, awesome. So I picked up on something here. So if you have to spend that much more to get a new drug to market, someone needs to do an environmental impact study to find out how much we could save or how many carbon credits could be earned by looking at off-patent medications that already have a bulk of the legwork and the heavy lifting done, and reusing those instead of this constant drive for something that's new. Because what is the environmental damage of doing that, right? Versus looking at the glut of products that we already have on the table that we could repurpose them, right?
So that's interesting there, Phil. So what you're trying to say is that give governments a different lens, yes, for which they can define the problem, because if they aren't defining the problem, like if there's some kind of reason, and this is what I, Sava, as you were talking, that I kind of chimed in on, is that, like, what if governments, and because you brought it up, what if governments were to really create strong incentives around repurposing generic drugs to the point where even large big pharma could create a viable business model in that, provide a lot more solutions. And if they were to put billions or tens of billions or collectively across the world, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars towards that kind of business model, like basically take what we're talking about here with crowdfunded cures and lean into that kind of business model, what would be the outcome of that? Well, part two to that is, okay, well, maybe they don't fully understand, or they're too vested in the existing system or whatever it might be, mm-hmm, for some reason.
That's it.
But, you know, what if you took the other lens of saying the environmental impact? Because if you just dollars don't necessarily equal carbon, you know, like carbon output, But it tends to be that a dollar is a store of wealth that shows the amount of resources that you can apply towards something. So it's not a perfect metric, but if you could say 30 million to 1 billion,
right,
and it's a 30-fold ratio,
right,
one could argue that maybe it's not 30 times the resources necessary to bring that drug to, you know, to market, but it's got to be at least 5 or 10 right, or 15. And then you could say, okay, what are the costs of resources from an environmental impact of the labs and all the people and all the transportation of those people and the buildings that they're in and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, so forth,
yeah,
because it's to create those pharmaceuticals. It'd be like a different angle to get them to pay attention to the same problem.
I mean, just do the analysis on every person that has to come to a clinical trial over years.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, that, yeah.
So you just the act of bringing them to the location to take part in the trial, just do that and you've saved hundreds of millions. Right. So it seems like there maybe is just has to take a different angle at them because it seems like a no brainer, right? It fits into the Green New Deal just fine.
Yeah, it does. Well, so that's that. Phil and I can kind of go on a rant here for a second. Yeah. So Nick, Sava, couple different things, I guess, to turn that. One, if you feel like you want to field that and that there's anything of interest there, please do. Two, full circle, if you don't and you just kind of want to go to the other thing, is what do you think the impact would be if governments did take a strong stance? Like, and do you think that's possible, I guess, is the more important question, is to get governments to take a strong stance that maybe repurposing off-patent drugs is the way to go? And if so, what would they need to see in order to follow through to do that?
Yeah, so I'm happy to sort of feel both. And I think you guys are getting the right idea around how basically to get, I think they're both related points, like how to get basically governments and health insurers to come on board, which is essentially doing, and this is what we're focusing on now, so do a feasibility study showing that the not really so much looking at the environmental impact, but the actual kind of healthcare cost savings that would result directly from a repurposed generic drug would far exceed the costs of a program, so under a pay-for-success model. So, for instance, if they agreed to pay $100 million for repurposed ketamine to treat depression, they would save $500 million. The VA, for instance, would save $500 million for $100 million. And that would create this kind of scalable business model to generate more funds and bigger funds and basically generate more savings. But in order to do that, you know, we need to do a feasibility study to kind of show, what are the current costs and then what would be the benefit from having more access to these curative drugs among a wider population, and then what would be the kind of the costs savings from that. But it's not actually that much of a difficult or intractable problem. A lot of governments already do that, particularly in England. They have the idea of a quality adjusted life year, which I guess is a little bit like a carbon credit, but for health. Basically, it's the price of 1 year of healthy life. And typically, that's around $30,000. That's how they kind of price it. Although for end-of-life drugs and some orphan drugs, you know, it can be up to sort of $100,000, $150,000. But they use that as a metric to basically figure out how much we're going to pay for this new drug. And it tends to be a new patented drug. But if they could do the same and calculate, like, the number of qualities that would be generated from a repurposed drug in advance and then put that in a bounty and then make sure that they could actually end up paying a much lower cost for a quality. They might only pay like $10,000 or $5,000 per quality, which makes it a lot more cost effective and basically would outcompete patented drugs. And so this would be a way to essentially save governments and health insurers money and invest more in things like preventative medicine, preventative care, and things like that, which ultimately end up saving even more qualities. So I think that's one of the answers. And the other thing is that from what it looks like, most health, most governments and insurers, that this sort of healthcare costs are just increasing exponentially. We've also got the aging baby boomer population and all the associated costs with that. So I think it's out of necessity they might have to look at what's more efficient ways for us to get more qualities. How do we generate more health for a limited budget?
Yeah, I mean, it, it just seems so apparent, and maybe, I don't know, maybe I am foolish for thinking it's apparent to me because maybe I'm misunderstanding something, but if the concept of a bounty works, which I believe it does, if there is $100 million to be offered for a bounty, it's because there is $150, $200, $250 million in savings to someone, clearly a health insurance provider or a government or whatever it might be. I'd say those seem to be the big two. You've identified them. Those are the ones that I would think of. So if there is a clear return on investment, meaning that the savings are greater than the expense of the bounty, it almost seems like why, I can't wrap my head around, like, if you're a government, why don't you just go deep on that? Like, why don't you just, like, that seems to be the move. Like, and if they're bounties, then you don't have anything to lose unless you get the results. I mean, why not put up like $100 billion worth of bounties and be like, all right, have at it.
I think that you maybe that you're coming from the assumption that these people are on the different sides of the ball. And my argument would be that possibly they're too intertwined together that they can't see the forest through the trees, so to speak. Right, because they're all, you know, the VA, the FDA, the insurance companies, I think they're all so closely intertwined together that I think that just looking out for their own best interest, and they're all, their interests are aligned, possibly.
So, and that very well could be true, or some combination. I'd love to hear, Nick Sava, what your thoughts are on it. But like, I'm just thinking of how simple it would be, especially with a bounty system, to just say, hey, look, any time that you can cover this expense with a return on investment, basically take your entire budget, like the entire government U.S. spending budget for like the VA on something, and be like, all right, you offset this expense here and you get this kind of return here, meaning cut expenses even by 10, 20, 30% and just put a bounty for it. You got nothing to lose. Nobody hits the bounty, then, like, you know, there's no expense. But if you achieve the result and get the outcome, then you know as a government you're going to save the money. So why not have $1 trillion worth of bounties worldwide? I'm sorry, maybe I'm missing something here.
Yeah, I mean, what you're saying is, and again, like, this is conceptually having the idea of a bounty to pay for medicine or pay for a repurposed medicine is something new. And you talked about the senators and stuff earlier on, like, you know, they're not going to come around to this. If you propose this, yeah, I think Bernie Sanders talked about it, like the Medical Innovation Prize Fund, but, you know, everyone, but he was talking about abolishing patents altogether. So, and yeah, he was talking about a $60 billion, $80 billion prize fund. Now, when you start talking about those figures, that's just not doable. And, you know, if you start throwing around $1 trillion bounties, and people just, you know, they're not going to go for that. But even talking about $100 million bounty for something that is clearly better than other, like, generic ketamine is better than the patented version of ketamine, esketamine. It's more effective and it's much lower cost. But without that $100 million bounty, no one's going to do the clinical trials to prove that it works. And it's just simply the case. You know, it's just getting kind of the VA on board takes political will, and, you know, then you've got it's kind of been lacking because it's seen as something actually kind of innovative. This idea of using innovation prizes and bounties, like, there is actually a new legislation called the America Competes Act, which allows now federal agencies to authorize prizes or bounties up to $100 million without Congress approval. So it's a possibility, but you still got to, you know, we've been talking to a lot of people, like dozens and dozens of people, and, you know, particularly payers, and everyone is like, the problem is sort of institutional inertia. But, you know, with something like crypto, I think this is where the real opportunity comes in, because you've got, you know, a lot of forward-thinking people that want to kind of play around with these more, you know, find better ways of doing things, more efficient ways of doing things, more rational ways of doing things. And, you know, with bounties, you know, we can design them through smart contracts. We can raise an NFT fund. You know, you've got Bored Ape Yacht Club, which is $3 billion market cap. You know, so $100 million bounty made of, like, health impact NFTs for treatment of depression, or psychedelic NFTs to treat depression, is not sort of unheard of. But I think, you know, 10, 20 years ago, it would have been seen as extremely, you know, out there and novel. But it's just a matter of actually doing it. But yeah, I think if you start talking about $1 trillion bounties and things like that, and $80 billion sort of prize funds like Bernie was doing, I think what that does is kind of puts you into a kind of, people start to think, oh no, this is just some, you know, we're just smoking too much weed or whatever. And you know, it takes it out of people's reality. But even a $100 million bounty is out of the reality of like the VA, for instance.
Yeah.
But they should definitely do it.
Yeah. I mean, so to that point, and I recognize, I would have to agree with you as much as anyone. And you take this abstract concept of kind of like putting bounties on offsetting and creating solutions to problems that they already have and the size and volume of that. But you're right. It has to start small, kind of the simpler concept of a bounty around one or two or a handful of things. And that ties right into the question of why Web3. And I'm going to make a guess here, and I want you to please correct my guess to the best answer. But it seems like the underlying concept is that if governments aren't necessarily the easiest or first direction to go, because what proof of evidence or whatever it might be, the fact that a bounty system could work, et cetera, then the Web3 community, not just because of its fundraising, but because of its communal vision of collecting around an impact or around, you know, a purpose or, you know, something that they share with one another, that perhaps you're banking on the fact that Web3 might, as a community, might go, you know what, if we're going to value apes at $3 billion, maybe we can value, you know, 30 bounties at $100 million a pop at $3 billion, or even just $20 million or $100 million. And that can be a value to a Web3 community, so it can start somewhere, prove itself, and allow people to interact with it in a way where they can, you know, proof of helpfulness, proof of contributions with the NFTs, and really that gives this legs that it needs to go towards like the bigger market, which is the governments and health insurance. Now, is that an accurate guess, or is there kind of a different reason for coming into the Web3 space?
Yeah, so definitely the initial goal is to do an impact DAO, and there are a lot of DAOs already, like Gitcoin and Giveth, that are into this idea, and even you know, Protocol Labs who have Filecoin, and they're very into this idea of like creating markets for generation of public goods, essentially through the, say, issue of these impact certificates. So, you know, there are people already looking at this, and repurposed generic drug, a repurposed off-patent drug, could also be considered a public good, because as soon as people know which cheap drug will treat their disease, they can just go off and take it themselves. You know, that's the entire point, and that's why you need this kind of bounty model, because of, you know, it's basically there's free riding going on. But, you know, if you can get enough people behind, you know, wanting to like treat and cure depression, and they would, you know, because maybe they're depressed and they would find a value in a treatment that works, even if it was a psychedelic. And I think also, yeah, the crypto people are very much, they're also quite aligned with alternative psychedelics especially. So I think you'd find a lot of, yeah, hopefully a lot of support. And we're also working with SciDAO at the moment on that, and potentially particularly focused on a generic open ketamine project. But yeah.
So, gosh, these podcasts end fast, and there's so much more to talk about. So I'm going to round out just a couple things here with the last bit of time that we have. One is to ask some of the questions that are in the chat. And of course, two is to ask, what could crowdfunded cures use? Like, what do you need? Who are you looking for? But to start off, you talked about psychedelics. Maria in the chat asks, how are you handling the future use of psychedelics if most of them are illegal to use?
So something like ketamine is not illegal to use in a clinical setting, and most psychedelics these days you can use them in a clinical setting. So they might be illegal recreationally, but not medically. So, you know, things like MDMA. I think psilocybin is still not allowed, but, you know, there are jurisdictions that will allow it. I think in Canada will be coming around, I think, and maybe sort of, yeah, in the next 5 years or so. But we're sort of initially focusing on, yeah, I mean, things like cannabis, ketamine, where you can actually get a doctor to prescribe it.
Brilliant. Yeah, I lived in Colorado for some time, and they're pretty progressive with all of that. So it's nice to see that changing. Shelley asked in the chat, you know, Are there other things like metformin used as an anti-diabetic and cancer therapeutic? And just in general, to kind of take that question, maybe add something to it. Specifically, I know in one of your other talks, you talked about fluvoxamine. For those who are listening and go, okay, what's something that actually matters to me? Maybe you can kind of take that metformin question and answer it, and or turn that into like, what's something that is a very obvious use case that could help people right now, but just doesn't have the legs because it's off patent.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of examples. I think fluvoxamine is a great one just because it works just as well as molnupiravir and BARDA. Basically, the US government agency paid $1.2 billion for 1.7 million courses of fluvoxamine. It has similar efficacy to, they paid for molnupiravir, which has similar efficacy to fluvoxamine, and the same with the UK government, paid $1.5 billion. Metformin definitely is a great example. Like, it's got a lot of uses, particularly, things like, the most obvious one is sort of life extension, sort of anti-aging, but it's even been used for things like tuberculosis and things like that. So there's a lot of drugs that have multiple uses that could be useful. As far as also what we're looking for, I mean, obviously, come onto the website, come to the Discord at the bottom right of the website. There's our socials. We're just kind of trying to get some people talking about it, essentially. I think this is the main point now, is just that, you know, people that can raise awareness and connect us with people, and particularly with government, but we're just happy to talk to any folks.
Yeah, well, guys, we're excited to have you here, and we will keep talking about it, right? We see the value in this, and we really believe that, I'll speak for myself, I believe that this is the kind of project that can open people's eyes to the potentials of Web3 and what is to come and what we can do if we really get together and decide that we're going to take care of any issue. So for me, it's very powerful, and appreciate you guys coming here. Nick, do you have anything you'd like to add?
No, Sava had has done a great job going over everything. He's the real expert here. I'm just also bullish on Web3 being able to create internet community where we can start funding projects that have been underfunded, generic drugs, looking at alternative therapeutics. I mean, it's such a cool nascent area that is developing. So, great for having us on this podcast and providing us with a platform to discuss. Really cool.
Yeah. Thank you very much for coming on. We really enjoyed it.
Yeah. So speaking of which,
thanks.
We feel compelled to have conversations like this. And quite frankly, like Phil said, I'll also second that. I can't think of anything off the top of my head that I'd be as passionate about.
Yeah.
Than crowdfunded cures. It's a clear, obvious opportunity to help people and like That's in right. real life. And like, we tend to sometimes detach ourselves in these intellectual conversations and just talk about concepts like governments of this, that, and the other. But at the end of the day, there's somebody on the other side who is mm-hmm. either suffering or dying or dealing with some kind of issue. And the difference of whether or not this kind of concept works or not is the difference of actual lives, like people we care about, the people we love.
Yeah.
And whenever we can attach that, hey, the person you're looking at, that they're going through something and they're in pain and there's some way to actually support them, but just the system itself doesn't really allow for them to get that treatment. But you can make a difference by getting involved in this Web3 community, by purchasing an NFT, by donating, by contributing effort into the Discord or wherever else. And we're going to ask about that in a second. Like, whenever it becomes real, it stops being about monkeys, monkey
that's
NFTs.
Right. That's right.
And I feel like it's our purpose, at least mine specifically. And I know, Phil, you agree because we've had those conversations, to spend our lives like changing the lens to that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right.
So to that point, if someone was listening to this and they say, you know what, this is the rest of my life now. I want to dedicate myself to this, or I want to dedicate some portion of myself to this, whether it's just a couple hours a week or a couple minutes a week, or just to say hi and say, hey, great job, keep doing what you're doing, or to donate money, or to connect you two or the community with maybe a politician they might know who's in the middle of writing a bill, or whatever it might be. How would that person get involved, one? And two, what could you really, really use right now? Like, what's the thing that crowdfunded cures could use the most, and like, where would you send them?
Well, yeah, definitely get in touch. Reach out, come to our Discord. I think that's probably the easiest way, or the Telegram group. Come on to that. So our socials are on the bottom right of our website. Obviously, you know, donations, fantastic. But you know, from our perspective, we're all kind of volunteers at this stage. But, you know, we do want to try and scale this as an impact DAO. Yeah, keep an eye on it. Once we do this psychedelic medicine NFT drop, you know, keep an eye on that, and you know, help support this model and prove that it works. Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, like, I'm all in, and this is like my passion. I did my thesis on it, and I can't think of anything more important that I could be doing right now. And I really appreciate, you know, Nick coming on board so last year, and you guys as well, like, sort of realizing that, yeah, this is an important thing. So yeah, the more people I think that are into this, that can get involved and that can help out, I think the more chance that it'll happen. But you know, I'm also believe that, you know, even if we move the needle slightly, I think it would be worth it. And but yeah, I also agree that this could be a sort of gateway drug or whatever, as it were, into like Web3, into showing exactly like how Web3 can actually save, you know, make real world changes. You know, imagine if we treated depression, came up with a cure for depression based on an off patent therapy. That would, you know, that would provide billions of dollars worth of value. Even one treatment that works slightly better than any other treatment is still worth billions of dollars. So that would be a very real thing. And you know, I think, yeah, so definitely. Yeah, but we do need help communicating it. It is obviously an abstract concept, probably like marketing people, yeah, things like that. But yeah,
well, I can
just feel free to reach out.
I can speak for myself and for the DOI Foundation. We will do everything in our power to communicate it in a way that the common person can understand its impact,
yeah,
because it matters to us.
Yeah, we're going to be your cheerleaders for sure.
Yeah, for sure.
We really like it.
All right. Well, thank you so much. That's really, yeah, it's awesome. We're going to need that, but amazing. Yeah.
So yeah, now the NFT drop. So one more thing I have to ask just before we unfortunately have to close this podcast eventually, and we're a few minutes past time, and every minute has been worth it. The NFT drop. Do you have a guess for everybody who's kind of listening to this in the future? You know, granted it's July 28th, but they could be listening to this on Spotify or iTunes or whatever later on, so they can kind of keep an eye out and just kind of stay involved in when that NFT drop might be. Is that Q4 of this year, Q1 of next, or?
I think we are looking at any time in the next few months. Something recently that we've looked at is syndicate.io, using Syndicate as a way of coordinating this. Yeah, so that would provide a lot of the back end. But yeah, we will be working with SciDAO. I think keep an eye on it, say next 2 months, hopefully that's the target. But, you know, it, yeah.
Nice. Coming up quick. You know, when you guys are ready to release, please hit us back up and come back in, and we'd love to do an update with you.
Yeah.
That would be awesome.
Awesome. We'll do. Yeah. Sure. Thanks so much. Awesome.
And I'm going to buy one of those NFTs too.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. That's investing into humanity right there. And that's what we're all about.
Thank you. Awesome.
All right, gang. So we're going to have to take off. Unfortunately, we are at the end of our allotted time for today. Sava and Nick, we appreciate you guys coming in. Gang, we will have our next episode posted.
It's going to be next week, Wednesday, and we're going to be bringing in Adam Miller to talk about all the different changes that have been happening in the Marshall Islands.
Yeah.
The opportunities to incorporate as a DAO.
Awesome. So that's going to be next Wednesday's regular time.
Regular time, 8 to 9.
8 p.m. Central. That's awesome. And that'll be a great conversation to catch up on. So, gentlemen, we appreciate you coming in. And we're going to take off for the day. For myself, Phil Ward, Sava, Nick, and for Corey Fico, we invite you to be kind to somebody. It changes lives. You guys take care, and we will see you soon.
Thanks for listening to the DOI Podcast. If you've enjoyed our time together, please rate and review the podcast. Together, we can achieve a brighter future. Help us bring this information to the world by sharing it with friends and family. The DOI Coin, the crypto coin for the people, by the people.